Jane went to medical school in London. She did her training at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, England, before moving to the U.S., where she took a position at Massachusetts General Hospital in 1990 and would direct the pain program at Mass General for about 20 years. She is currently at the University of Washington, where she's a professor of education and research. And she is the president of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. I think that in the opioid saga, I think Jane is one of the unsung heroes. In 2003, when many in the medical community were still under the delusion that the compassionate way to treat chronic pain was with aggressive opioid prescribing, Jane had begun to figure out from her clinical experience and from some research experience that what we were being taught and what many of us were even teaching about opioids was wrong. And in fact, she published an important paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003 outlining concerns about chronic opioid therapy, in particular high-dose opioid therapy. At the time that her paper came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, there were many in the pain community who were rallying behind a doctor in Virginia, I'm blanking on his name, who was on trial for very aggressive prescribing of opioids. He had multiple patients who had died of an overdose. And the pain community was rallying to his defense. In particular, they were defending his use of very high doses of opioids. And when Jane's paper came out of the New England Journal of Medicine criticizing high-dose opioid therapy. So you could imagine that people were not too happy with her. And although Jane has been outspoken about chronic opioid therapy and has angered some of the pain community, I think that even some of the folks who don't like her positions, they like Jane. She's just has a demeanor that it's hard to not like her. And it's just terrific to have her at the helm of PROP, and I think we'll be treated by a great presentation this evening.
Well, this is Jane Ballantyne. Thank you, Andrew. Am I being heard okay?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was asked by all of you to follow up on Andrew's presentation and to focus on the issue of what the role of opioids is in the treatment of chronic pain. So I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes because I believe that you would like a shortish presentation with plenty of time for questions. And so I'm going to touch a little bit on opioids and the FDA, but really focus on what we now understand about chronic pain and opiates and the use of opiates. Actually, since Andrew mentioned it, I just published a perspective piece in the New England Journal of Medicine, so that's my second publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm being absolutely slaughtered by patients and mainly by the patient groups and journalists who are in support of patient groups. This is a paper that talks about how the titrate to effect principle, which is very much related to the earlier idea that the high doses are the problem, that a focus on pain intensity has not been helpful, and that we should be thinking more about functional outcomes and quality of life and not completely about a 0 to 10 pain scale. But anyway, for this presentation, I believe you can see my slides.
Yes.
So I know that I don't need to speak to this group of people about what the FDA actually does, but in terms of its role in our advocacy with the FDA. We really focused on the third of these bullet points, and that is that drugs are usually evaluated through the process of RCT, so that's through the process of development as well as phase four trials and getting drugs onto the market. And the safeguards against having made wrong decisions in that process of the randomized trials are the mandatory reporting of adverse events and post-marketing surveillance. The big question is for the FDA is what exactly constitutes evidence in terms of post-marketing surveillance. And the big question with opioids is, first of all, to what degree or how can they evaluate the harm of addiction per se and the deaths that arise out of addiction per se, and how can they balance that against maintaining access to patients who need opioids? So it's very much part of their decision process. The problems that we've seen or that we have been perceived by PROP and others is, first of all, that randomized trials only test short-term effects, and that applies not just for safety, because a lot of the problems with opioids are only manifest after at least months of treatment, and some of them are not manifest for years of treatment, until after years of treatment, and also the issue of efficacy. Randomized trials or short-term use of opiates, I think we've known for hundreds of years that short-term use is pretty effective, that opioids are capable of reducing pain levels by about 30%. But the big question is to what degree is that efficacy maintained, and then ultimately how do you balance that against the safety considerations. And also that the mechanisms utilized for some of these studies actually manipulated to increase the likelihood of getting FDA approval. So they're making drugs look better than they are in real-world populations by, first of all, enriched in enrollment. That means that the analgesics are tested. A new analgesic is tested on a cohort of patients, and only the patients who are sensitive to that opioid or who do well on that opioid are actually put into the trial. The patients are very highly selected. In fact, that patients who have any risk factors for abuse, and that includes many of the risk factors for the development of chronic pain, such as any psychiatric comorbidity, particularly depression, anxiety, but in terms of substance abuse risk, patients with a family history or a personal history of substance abuse are actually selected out of these studies, so it's not really reflecting a real-world population, and also very careful selection of the drug that it's compared to or the placebo that it's compared to. So the mechanism is basically designed so that drugs can get FDA approval as quickly as possible. The reason that PROP has spent a lot of its energy and effort with advocacy with the FDA is that it sees that labeling of drugs is very important. First of all, because an on-label use suggests that it's sanctioned by the FDA and therefore assumed to be safe. That an on-label indication can be marketed so the pharmaceutical industry can support advertising as well as CME education about any drug that's on-label and obviously has to make statements if it's an off-label indication. The thing that Andrew's been particularly concerned about that is that every time a new opioid is launched, there's a spike in opioid usage, so it encourages greater usage of opioids in general, even though it's aimed at a particular opioid, because the marketing is sort of reminding people of the value of opioids. And also that it's not so much that it matters whether there's only one opioid on the market versus many opioids on the market, but it's human nature every time there's a new opioid to assume that it's better than the previous opioids, but also that it's safer than the previous opioids. In fact, many of the new opioids have been marketed with the message that they're safer than previous opioids. That's particularly true of long-acting opioids when they first came in. So this is this actually comes from Andrew. It's an example of the sort of misleading advertising that makes it look as if you can go from really being crippled with pain to being perfectly robust and healthy, and that is the nature of some of this advertising, or the suggestion that complex challenges can have a simple solution, or that it's very much part of what comes across all this marketing, and that is that opioids offer the answer to chronic pain and are a simple solution for chronic pain, which anybody who treats chronic pain knows that there is no simple solution. There are other myths that the marketing actually propagated. That's that opioids are not addictive if they're used for pain. That was very much part of the early marketing by Purdue when they launched OxyContin and promoted it specifically for chronic pain. That long-acting opioids are less addictive and more effective than short-acting opioids. So the message in that case was that because you have a steady state, you don't have periods of breakthrough pain, so patients don't need to focus on getting the next dose of opiates because they have opiates in the system the whole time. And that because it's a steady state and because they're not having the highs that go with short-acting opiates, that they're less addictive. They're also putting about the message that some of the addictive behaviors are not addiction at all, they're pseudo-addiction. And that means that if you give opiates and it fixes the pain, the behaviors go away, or that the behaviors were only there because the pain wasn't adequately managed. In other words, when you see addictive behaviors, you can treat the addictive behaviors by increasing the opioid dose. There are also a message that there's no such thing as analgesic tolerance. So there's general agreement that there's tolerance to the euphoric effects of opioids, but a lot of pain specialists argue and still argue to this day that there's no such thing as analgesic tolerance. And also part of the early message was that there was no concern about higher doses. So the correct way to use opioids was to use whatever doses needed to bring down the pain score. And there was no need to be cautious about high doses. That was in the early teaching. Nowadays, I don't think that teaching can fly because it's so clear that the higher doses are associated with a lot of the problems with opiates. So our questions have been, should the label for chronic pain be removed completely now that we've had an initiative to try and get the FDA to change the label in terms of dose and duration, and they haven't agreed to do that, although they did agree to change the wording of indications from moderate to severe and to eliminate the word moderate so that now the FDA label says it's only suitable for severe pain and not for moderate pain. But we don't really know how well opioids work for chronic pain. We do know that there's no scientific evidence to support efficacy, long-term efficacy, but there's also no scientific evidence as such that they don't work long-term. It's one of the problems we have. We don't have evidence in either direction. We don't really know if tolerance or the need for increasing doses is a problem, and we don't know if the problem of misuse, abuse, and death is confined to those other than pain patients. In other words, a lot of the claims have been that pain patients taking opioids as prescribed will not get into trouble with misuse, abuse, and death, and the statistics on misuse, abuse, and death are confined to non-pain patients. And there's the question of whether adverse effects actually outweigh the benefits. So I'm sure you've seen this before, but I think this is the most telling of all the slides that we show, and that is that between 1999 and 2010, the deaths and treatment admissions both went up dramatically, but they went up in direct parallel, direct correlation with opioid sales. In other words, the increased use of opioids for the treatment of pain, and that actually lies in almost entirely with the treatment of chronic pain with opioids, because treatment of acute and end-of-life pain with opioids has not increased. Only the incidence of opioids being used for chronic pain. So the fact that this has gone up in parallel with abuses and deaths is pretty telling in terms of why we're seeing these increased abuses and deaths. So current evidence, excluding randomized controlled trials, because randomized controlled trials really don't tell us anything about long-term efficacy or safety, but observational studies do to some extent. And in fact, when the movement to use more opioids began, the evidence that was cited was always these observational studies. And the observational studies are mostly case series and open-label follow-up studies, and they do actually support the efficacy and safety of opioids. But generally, the doses are low to moderate, so these studies just aren't looking at high-dose therapy. And the length of treatment, although it's much longer than the randomized controlled trial, is still only 1 to 2 years. And pain relief is only partial. And I think most important thing that we've learned from these observational studies is that most people, the majority of people, it's estimated about 60%, of people who have started on opioids actually discontinue because they don't like the adverse effects, or they don't feel they're getting adequate pain relief, or they simply don't like being on opioids. So when you look at, if you summarize the observational data, it actually makes opioid treatment look pretty good. When you look at epidemiological data, which actually came in much later than the observational data, the treatment doesn't look as good. So when you're looking at a much wider population, first of all, analgesic effectiveness is not substantiated. In fact, people are on opioids at high dose and for a long time, according to epidemiological studies, have much higher pain scores, higher pain ratings, and less good efficacy than patients who are not treated, so match cohorts who are not treated with opiates at all. The function of opioid-treated patients seems poor when you look across populations. Most of the lack of safety of opioids that we are all aware of now has been revealed by epidemiological studies, not by observational studies. And also, we're beginning to see from population studies this phenomenon of what we've called adverse selection, and that is that the people that tend to stay on opiates and the people that get to high doses are the very people who are at high risk. So they're the very people that you might predict would be at risk of continued opioid treatment. They're the patients I mentioned before with comorbidities, psychiatric comorbidities, particularly depression, anxiety, and people with substance abuse risk factors, particularly a past history of substance abuse. So the longer duration and higher doses are associated with most, in fact, of the adverse outcomes. So they're associated with higher rates of overdoses and death, less likelihood of being able to wean when you need to wean, such as when people are at the end of life or when they're preparing for surgery because they're going to have a hard time coping with pain if they're very tolerant to opioids during surgery. If you want to wean when a young woman gets pregnant, it becomes very difficult. There are higher rates of mental health and substance use disorder, and they're less able to control their usage. They have the high dose have higher rates of falls and fractures, particularly elderly. They're less likely to return to full functioning or work. They have higher rates of endocrinopathies, particularly testosterone depletion, and higher rates of immune dysfunction. So over time, we've been able to see that there really is a problem with the higher doses. Apart from all the adverse effects, higher doses are, I think most clinicians consider them a red flag. It may be that the pain is simply not responsive, so you're continuing to increase a dose but not actually getting very good pain relief from it. It may be that the tolerance developed is insurmountable or no dose is enough. Or the patient maybe just have difficulty controlling the use, so they're using inappropriately, or there may be frank misuse, addiction, or diversion. But high doses are always considered a red flag in today's environment. What's actually happening, what's behind this, is I think, and we've published on this, that when you take opioids continuously and for a long time, you inevitably develop tolerance and dependence. So when you work in a pain clinic or a primary care clinic, you will have patients who clearly have become addicted and meet DSM criteria for addiction. And you'll have a few patients who don't display any sign at all of struggling with their opiates. They're the so-called model patient who never loses prescriptions, never goes to the ER, never asks for early prescriptions or asks for dose escalation, and has clean urines, and the prescription monitoring looks fine. But most patients do not fit in either of those extremes. There are so many patients that are in the gray zone where we don't really know, where they don't behave entirely perfectly, but they don't meet criteria for addiction, and something's going on, and most of them in the gray zone are not actually getting very good pain relief from the opioids. So what we understand about opioid dependence, because I think that's what's going on in this gray zone, is that, and we get this from the addiction literature, when you start taking an opioid, you get very good euphoric effect and you get a very good analgesic effect. But over time, you stop oscillating around above the norm and you start to oscillate below the norm. In other words, an addict who's become addicted through illicit use will tell you that they no longer get euphoria and they're not taking or seeking the opioid to get high. They need the opioid in order to stop feeling really bad or getting dysphoria. And you see exactly the same thing happening with pain patients. That if they can't get hold of the opiate, the pain gets so much worse that not only are they desperate to get opiate, they're also convinced that they need opiates because their pain is so severe unless they can get opiates. But part of that is a function of being tolerant and dependent. So one of the difficulties we have is that we don't have a good concept in our minds about what pain patients who become dependent on opioids look like, as distinct from individuals that become dependent on opiates or addicted to opiates through illicit usage. But many of the criteria for this phenomenon are actually exactly the same as DSM criteria for abuse. That is, the social disruption, loss of control over use, and continued use despite harm occur in both groups of patients, but they're usually attributed to pain, in the case of pain patients, where they might be attributed to addiction in the case of illicit use. I put craving in parentheses because craving may not actually be manifest in patients who are continually treated with opiate, or in other words, because the doctors continue to prescribe opiates, they're essentially being maintained on opiates, particularly if they're continuously prescribed long-acting opiates. So the main difference is that the behaviors of pain patients is that they are pestering reluctant doctors. They're using opiate to treat pain, but they're also using opiate to treat withdrawal, and the predominant symptom for these patients in withdrawal is actually pain. The illicit usage individual that behaviors are all centered on the need to procure opioids. So they're different behaviors. And one thing that's very different is that pain patients do not accept that there's anything wrong other than pain. It's very hard for them to understand their dependence. Whereas illicit usage, if they're seeking help for addiction, they're usually open to the diagnosis of addiction and they're open to the treatment for addiction. There is this issue, particularly with pain patients, that you really can't separate tolerance and dependence, that the tolerance drives withdrawal symptoms because there's a need for a greater dose, and if a greater dose isn't given, then these pain patients are going to start experiencing increased pain, not just because pain might have increased, but also because they're not able to get a sufficient dose because they've become tolerant. And so you see this relationship between the hyperalgesia and analgesia in pain patients. So in that case, the opiate really isn't helping them very much because every time the dose goes down, they're desperate to get further doses. This is just a slide to show how many studies there are now that actually show this adverse selection effect, that people with no mental health diagnoses are far less likely to dose escalate and get to these high doses. So in conclusion, the problems seem to be centered on high-dose users. The safety data are compelling, and even though causation can't be proved from the epidemiological data, I think this evidence has to be factored into any assessment of effectiveness. And there's no convincing data that opiates are effective in the long term, and that's one of the problems I think we have, is that it's very hard to show any of this scientifically, and whether you're developing guidelines or trying to persuade the FDA to change their policies on labeling, lack of scientific evidence is really standing in the way. But there comes a point where I think you have to decide what evidence is important enough. So the safety data that are coming out, certainly the CDC has responded to this issue because the CDC's role is to protect populations. And so I think that's all I have to say, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you. That was fantastic. Yes. Really very helpful. So
actually, I just put up another slide to just...
Oh, okay.
You know, the way we're thinking, in fact, that certain chronic pain diagnoses, if we didn't use opiates for them, we would reduce the usage significantly. And now I have finished.
Thank you. Okay, the floor is open for questions. And comments. If people want to unmute themselves.
This is Andrew. I just wanted to make one comment, aside from the fact that I thought that was a great overview and presentation, Jane. With regard to the lack of evidence, when it comes to medical interventions, whether it's a procedure, whether it's a medication, if for that medical intervention you're lacking evidence that it's helpful, you're lacking evidence that it's effective, and yet you've got good evidence of significant risks, then that, a medical intervention where we know there are significant risks and yet we don't know that it's going to be helpful to patients, those are medical interventions that should be prescribed rarely. And that's really the crux of the issue, is that opioids are being prescribed very commonly for these conditions, despite the lack of evidence to support use and the significant evidence of risk.
James, it's not that we just. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. That's right.
I'm really interested in research I've been reading about how opioids mitigate emotional pain, and I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, like that specific description of emotional pain.
Endogenous opioids have a very important role in emotional pain and in bonding and in socialization. And one of the theories of, you know, the reason people feel better with opioids is that if there's been a deficiency in that sort of bonding, particularly during childhood, that sometimes taking exogenous opioids sort of makes up for that lack of bonding. So you know, there is in the chronic pain field, there is no doubt that patients with really severe, complex chronic pain. So I don't want to paint chronic pain with a single brush, because I don't think it is a single thing. But the complex chronic pain patients that are the type of patients that we see in chronic pain clinics very rarely don't have some sort of underlying problem from childhood. Sometimes it's from adults, so it's very common to see post-traumatic stress disorder and history of childhood abuse. And one of the theories is that there is changed development of the opioid systems, endogenous systems, which makes them more susceptible to becoming dependent and addicted to exogenous opioids.
Right. Yeah, thank you.
So, hi, this is Susan. And how about, I'm a psychiatrist too, and supposedly opioids predispose people, you know, chronic opioids predispose people to depression. And that's what I tell people when they're, you know, when I see that opioids are a problem. But is there really, how good is the evidence backing that?
Yeah. Well, chronic pain and depression go hand in hand.
Right, yeah, that's true.
And nobody really knows whether chronic pain causes depression or depression causes chronic pain. You know, nobody's really got to them. And
no,
I don't know if we can get to the bottom of it. But
yeah,
whether,
tough.
I mean, opiates, I think the problem with clinical problem with opiates in depressed individuals is that, I believe anyway, that the effect on the endocrine systems, and particularly the effect on libido and drive,
yeah,
doesn't help depression, because they don't have any motivation to,
right,
to change their lives or to get back to work or do
right,
pleasurable things, because they've just lost their libido,
right,
and energy, and
yeah,
just,
right,
so it worsens depression. And depression is very prevalent in them anyway.
It is, so it's hard to, yeah, so I was just wondering if there's anything, that statement isn't from randomized controlled trials or anything. I've heard it a lot over the years, and you know, as a rule, it's not good for people to be on, you know, chronic opioids. So you know, when I see somebody who's not moving forward in their lives and is depressed, I tell them, well, you know, you really need to get off these drugs, and I tell them that. But I don't know how good the evidence is backing it up. I guess, this, you know, from what I usually consider evidence, you know, as randomized controlled trials, you know, or really solid observational studies. So it's not it's not really there. And I know
This is Andrew. I think there it has been demonstrated that testosterone deficiency is linked to depression. I think there is decent evidence supporting that, whether it's mediated through the decrease in libido and drive or it's a direct effect. But certainly low testosterone has been linked to depression, and we know that chronic opioid use, particularly high doses, as Jane was saying, does reduce testosterone.
Okay. Well, that's something that will motivate the guys. So, that's good to know. Okay, thanks.
It does, actually. When you tell them, and I think we're remiss, and we don't always tell male patients that the opiate they're taking is going to reduce their testosterone, but when you tell them, sometimes it's the thing that makes them want to work with you to get off.
Right. Well, if you hit him with the testosterone, a lot of times, it is motivating, I'm afraid.
Then they ask for testosterone replacements.
Well,
and then you get into that.
I know.
One thing I didn't know until, I don't remember, Andrew, whether you were part of this, was that testosterone replacement doesn't make them fertile again.
No. That's not the answer, huh?
This is Joe, and I was wondering, what would you like to see in pain guidelines, like the one that's coming out from the CDC? I had a look at the CDC guidelines, and I was looking to see if there's some kind of recommendation that there should be, you know, significant functional impairment that, is significantly improved, in the long run. And that's probably we probably can't expect the guidelines to say, you know, pretty much just don't use long-term opiates for chronic pain. They're never going to say that. But at the least, you know, we would hope that they would be very clear about this, very severe functional impairment criteria. And to me, it seems like the functional impairment should be very severe. But how would you explain that to and giving advice to a doctor who's trying to decide about prescribing opiates?
Well, I first of all, it is as clear as you can be, I think, in the new CDC guidelines that, you know, that function and quality of life are important outcomes. But I would say that if you are advising doctors who are making a decision or trying to measure outcomes, that is, I absolutely agree that functional impairment is far more important than the pain score. That's what the New England Journal article is actually about, but that we make the mistake when we try to drive down pain scores, because we often do that at the expense of function. In other words, we're using opiates to drive down pain scores, but we're actually making function and quality of life worse. And so I agree it's very important. And there are some measures at University of Washington. We have what's called the pain tracker that was developed here by Mark Sullivan, which really focuses on, first of all, on pain interference rather than just the pain score. So how much does pain interfere with the things you want to do in life? And on patient satisfaction, and on it has measures of depression, anxiety. So it's a very, you know, as quick as it could be to incorporate all those things. But I think I would advise any practitioner using opioids to use a broad tool like that and not to just focus on pain intensity, because the intensity as such is not a kind way to treat pain, because it often leads to all these worsening of life rather than making it better.
Seems like there's no role for a pain score.
Well, I think you probably, even if it's not used as a primary outcome measure, it's a useful it's still a useful measure of, because if you improve life in other ways, like you make people more accepting or more active, or get back to, you know, doing things they like doing, including going to work or feeling, you know, useful role in society, that their pain will improve, actually. And that's a good thing to be able to show, that their pain intensity will go down. And that's a good thing to be able to show, that everything you're doing and the treatments you're offering are actually, without driving down a pain score with opiates, are actually reducing pain intensity. Or maybe they're just reducing the amount of distress associated with pain, but either way, it's a good outcome.
Is there anything
my special? Name is Brandon. I'm an emergency physician. I had two questions for you. One, I really liked your slide that described sort of the progression of symptoms in patients as they become more and more dependent on opioids. The fact that hyperalgesia is part of this syndrome, I think, is poorly recognized by many of my colleagues. And I've had some success trying to explain to patients that I know they're in pain, but me giving them more opioids is not, you know, in the long term going to make things any better. And I guess I would love to know what your thoughts are on educating physicians about recognizing that withdrawal symptoms are perhaps much more common than we would think. And my second question for you is that many of my colleagues feel like they're driven by quality metrics such as the Medicare you know, questions about how well was your pain treated during your emergency department visit. And do you think that, at least I interpret those quality metrics as sort of one of the long-standing effects of, you know, the push to promote more opioid use and, you know, pain is a fifth vital sign, things like that. Do you think that we're going to see any movement on changing those policies?
Yeah. So to answer your first question, I think that, you know, a lot of people are now putting educational efforts out there to retrain physicians and try and turn things back from the position of the 80s and particularly early 90s, where these myths that I described came about. And it's very hard to turn that around. But what I see, and I think everyone sees as well, is that physicians are turning around, that we're beginning to be able to change the opinion of physicians, and particularly because physicians are really struggling with managing these patients, and so they welcome a new way of thinking about it. With regards to your second question, Prop is actually, and Prop and many other people, maybe Andrew can answer this as well, are involved with trying to persuade to change the HCAP questions and the JCO mandate, to change some of the actual items in the JCO mandate, particularly the assessment item, because they did actually just change the treatment, what suggested treatment, but we see that there's a remaining problem with assessment and how widely it's expected to be done, pain assessment, and also the HCAP questions. I think a lot of people would agree that they're problematic and they're driving physicians to prescribe just to keep up patient satisfaction metrics. But maybe Andrew would like to comment as well.
Sure. I'll add a little bit to that. Prop, we actually did recently have a conversation with CMS regarding the HCAP scores. And for those of you not familiar with this issue, there are patient satisfaction questions that are asked of patients when they leave hospitals that include questions about whether or not the staff did everything they could to give you medication for your pain, and did you get enough medicine for your pain. And there's a concern that those questions are leading to or encouraging aggressive use of opioids in hospital settings. And for post-discharge, patients are being given more opioids on their way out from either an inpatient admission or an emergency room, more than they really need because of these questions. We have a letter that's going to go out, and the opioid work group, I think Becky may be updating folks about this, the MTA opioid work group is going to be partnering in that effort, and it's a letter that's going to have multiple co-signers. We may also, in conjunction with that letter to CMS, there'll be a letter to Joint Commission on the pain standards, but we may also file an administrative request to CMS to revise or remove those HCAHPS survey questions related to pain.
Actually, with regards to the education thing, where we haven't made as much progress and where there's still a long way to go is with patients, because it's become particularly, I mean, you notice this when you travel a lot, and I mean, I'm a pain physician and I meet pain physicians and patients all over the world, and American patients have this hang up about how they're not supposed to have pain at all. And it's very difficult to break that. And it's because of, you know, the idea that they were taught that doctors have a means to eliminate pain, when in fact doctors do not have a means to eliminate pain. And it's a problem in terms of just what is expected and the level of acceptance of pain that you really notice when you compare America to other countries.
And they expect it to be taken care of by a pill, whereas other modalities can be effective, like yoga or Pilates or, you know, exercise.
Are more effective, actually.
Yeah, they're more effective, right.
Yeah.
You know, I this is a fantastic discussion, and we could go on, I know, and I really appreciate everything you've done for us tonight. It's been great. But I think we do need to move on to some business, and I know to try to protect people's time, we should go ahead with our business portion of the meeting. But thank you so very much for this excellent presentation and the conversation. We really appreciate your coming to our meeting.
And you're very welcome.
Yeah, sometimes.